In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Welcome. So very glad you're joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show. As every week, we bring you a little more intelligence on big government. And of course, there is no bigger government than socialism in all of its forms. Socialism, communism, Marxism, fascism, and of course, the Nazis. So why is big government bad? We all know it's bad. Everyone, that is, except for Democrats currently running for the presidency as socialists, who, as a reminder, none of them have ever lived under a socialist regime, but I digress. To me, one of the most damning elements of big government is that to succeed, big government demands conformity from its subjects, which is odd because those on the political left shriek about diversity, but that's diversity of color, not of the mind or diversity of human spirit. For example, say you don't like the idea of killing unborn babies or trying to exercise free speech that goes against policies the government wants to enact. And don't you dare criticize socialist leaders who jet around the world on private airplanes to attend global warming conferences where they tell everyone else not to fly on commercial jets or eat meat or use natural gas to heat your homes. And don't you dare question how it is the dear leaders got to be multimillionaires with multiple mansions while hundreds of thousands of their people live on the streets. That sort of talk is not allowed. Now, hate is a universal problem, right or left, but the left seems drawn to this nowadays. They demand diversity of color, but also demand conformity of thought, which is why hate tends to bubble up from leftist big governments, especially hate in the form of anti-Semitism. Hatred of Israel is one step from hatred of Jews. And these mindsets are becoming almost mainstream on the left, including Democratic circles. And make no mistake, anti-Semitism is racial discrimination. But why does the left think discrimination against blacks is bad, but discrimination against Jews is okay? Perhaps it's because so many American ideals were founded on Judeo-Christian values. Love thy neighbor as thyself? Jesus made it famous, but that's Old Testament. Leviticus chapter 19. On today's show, it's the rise of anti-Semitism. Joining us now is Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and an activist against anti-Semitism. She's also the filmmaker of Never Again is Now, a terrific film about not forgetting the lessons of the Holocaust in the face of rising anti-Semitism going on right now across Europe and here in America. Dr. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on your show, Mark. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is such an important message to get out there. We're just seeing such a huge rise of anti-Semitism. And I watched your film last night, and it was just so very, very moving. And what really jumped out at me early on was the similarities, you know, the rise of hatred and anger aimed at Jews back in your parents' times in the 30s and 40s to what is really going on right now with anti-Semitism going across, spreading really across Europe and even right here in America. And we'll definitely come back around to that as in terms of what's going on today. But walk us through what it was like for your parents' time. What were some of the things that when they first started experiencing anti-Semitism, what were some of the things that they were going through?
Okay, my parents were Jews in Holland, and they grew up without significant anti-Semitism in Holland, as you can imagine. But that changed after Hitler came to power and took over the Netherlands. So it started with graffiti on Jewish homes and stores, anti-Semitic graffiti, the scolding of Jews, the beating up of Jews, then marking them with yellow stars. And then from that, it went into regulations that were restricting for Jews and then deportation. Mm. So it started with words and graffiti. And also, of course, the many, many speeches from Hitler where he announced that he would annihilate the Jews.
And none of that, they didn't really experience any anti-Semitism before the invasion, right? That's what I'm hearing?
No. Hmm. No, correct. And at first, nobody took it really serious. It was like, oh, it's just words, it's just graffiti. So now what I saw in my lifetime, I was born after World War II in Holland and grew up there also without anti-Semitism. But that changed in the year 2000. So suddenly I heard in the streets yells like, kill all the Jews, Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. I got a pink Star of David on the front door of me and my partner Rose's apartment. So those signs sounded familiar to me. And what my parents had taught me when I grew up was, they said, the lesson we have to learn from our experience, they said, is that we should have taken the early signs of Hitler more serious. We didn't. We thought it's just words. He's not going to do it. He's just saying that he's going to do it. And by the time we had to take him serious, it was too late.
Right,
he was
right.
Too strong. He was too strong to stop him. So that's why that explains the title of my documentary, Never Again Is Now. We see these beginning signs, just similar signs they saw in their lives. And now we have to learn the lesson that we have to curb this early on.
Well, so you said your parents... You said your parents didn't really take it seriously at first. And, you know, Jews have been hated for millennia, you know, going back to the Babylonian times or even all the way back to Egypt, the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, so at what point did your parents and the Jewish community as a whole begin to realize this was just not another typical episode of hating Jews, but is way more serious, way more deadly than all that?
Well, you know, it's human to... it's human to think, well, these things happened in the past, but it's not going to happen to me. And this time it's different. You know, that's a human reaction to something threatening. A human first reaction, to deny the threat. And that's exactly how they looked back at it. They said, you know, if you look at it in hindsight, we could have seen it, but being... living then at that moment, there were enough reasons you could tell yourself that this time it's going to be different from the past. So by the time that for them it was when the Nazis were turned out to have so much power that they were actually acting upon their words. And threat, that was when they realized they had to take it seriously, and it was too late.
Wow. Well, definitely frightening. Let's go ahead and take a break there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Evelyn Marcus. She's the filmmaker behind Never Again Is Now. Absolutely fantastic film about anti-Semitism, what's going on in Europe, and also what's going on right now in the U.S. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iFi Radio Show, talking today to Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and filmmaker, and an activist on anti-Semitism. She is the filmmaker behind Never Again Is Now. It is a terrific film. It's available on Amazon Prime, totally for free if you're a member there of Amazon Prime. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And in that last segment there, we were talking about the rise of anti-Semitism during your parents' time, and It really didn't seem to kick in until after the invasion there by Germany. And so why exactly did it suddenly ramp up? I mean, did people get swept up in this? Were the people in Netherlands, I mean, did they go along with the hate against the Jews? Or was it people coming in from outside, from Germany, that were, you know, like paid activists and whatnot to do the rabble rousing? So why did it ramp up when it wasn't there before?
A big part of it was the German occupiers of the Netherlands after May 10, 1940. Another part of it were collaborators. who organized themselves in a Dutch Nazi party. Another part, what we know from the Anne Frank diary, and that's an example of what happened a lot. The Germans deprived the Dutch of many basic goods. So there was poverty, there was scarcity, and they gave $7.50 compared to $7.50 to every Dutchman who would turn in a Jew that was hiding somewhere. Mm. That happened to the Frank family. They were betrayed by somebody in the building who was working there in the building and who heard some sound and thought, I'm going to get my $7.50.
Wow.
The Dutch were in a very difficult position to defend the Jews because there was not a military occupation and government, Nazi government, running the country. There was an SS government running the country. So that was extremely harsh. And the risks of saving Jews or trying to save Jews were immense. Now, my father was saved by evangelical Christians who took him in, and my uncle, his brother, and were hiding them throughout the Holocaust. So, and successfully hiding them, but they risked their own lives. If the Germans would have caught them and they came into the house to search it at some point, if they would have found the people hiding, then the people hiding them would certainly have been killed.
Mm.
But thank goodness that all went well. So there was a small amount of Dutch who would take that risk and stood up for their principle and saved Jews. But most Dutch didn't take that risk and just let it happen, didn't stand up for Jews. They saw what was going on. They saw the razzias. They saw roundups of Jews, and they just stayed passive.
Hmm. Well, what was that like for your parents? And I don't know how much they talked to you about that, but I mean, what was that like for them to grow up in a country where they were welcomed and they were members of the community, and but then to see their neighbors and their city begin to turn to hate. What was that like to experience that?
Well, they didn't see so much their environment turn into hate. They saw them turn into passivity.
Mm.
Not so much into active hate. You would see more of that active hate in countries like Poland. In Eastern Europe, the population was much more hateful towards Jews. But in Holland, it was more of, they just let it happen.
Mm.
They stood by.
Mm.
And again, the risks of doing more than standing by were big. So what they were disappointed about was the fact that the Dutch government fled Holland the moment it got occupied.
Yes.
Right before that, they fled to England, and they had radio shows every day that people would listen to called Radio Orange. Orange is the color of Holland, of the royal family. So they would broadcast every day, and they just once mentioned what happened with the Jews who were deported, that they were all killed and gassed. They mentioned it once in 5 years.
Wow.
And they didn't pay any attention to it in all those other daily shows. And that was a big disappointment to my parents.
Well, what was it like after the war when your parents came back and, you know, you've got these neighbors who either wouldn't or couldn't stand up for themselves, and the Dutch government comes back, and you know they clearly had let down the Jewish communities. What was that like? How did they start to rebuild their lives and rebuild those relations with the people around them?
My parents were first and foremost occupied with getting their home back, creating an income, because everything was gone of what they had been building. And most importantly, they found each other back. They were split up when they were engaged. One was going into hiding. The other one was deported to the concentration camp. So my mother was in the concentration camp. She came back from Bergen-Belsen, and which was a miracle in itself. As she always told me, if the liberation by the Americans would have been 1 week later, she would not have been alive anymore. She was severely ill. Mm. But she made it, and she found out that her fiancé was still alive, who had made it into hiding, what I just described to you before. So they got reunited and were so happy to find each other back that they got married in 1946, started a family, and my father started the business. And, you know, they were totally focused on that.
Yeah, making up for lost time, for sure.
Yeah.
Let's go and take a break there. Coming back, we'll have more with Dr. Marcus. Evelyn Marcus, she is an activist against anti-Semitism. Her film, once again, Never Again, is now available on Amazon Prime. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and the filmmaker behind Never Again is Now. It's available on Amazon.com. If you're a Prime member, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And so, Dr. Marcus, you were talking about your parents there, and I think your mom's story is so absolutely fascinating. She had been deported to one concentration camp. It was kind of a holding point, I guess, for a lot of different camps. And then she was being sent in April, I believe it was, in April of 1945, being sent to like one of the main Holocaust camps. And on the way there, the train was stopped because there was artillery shelling and bombing going on in the area. Talk to us a little bit about your mom's rescue, because it is really just fascinating.
So my mother, like all Dutch Jews, was sent together with her parents, her brother, her sister, first to the Dutch concentration camp, Westerbork, where the Germans put all the Jews they rounded up before they would ship them further eastward. So they were at the camp Westerbork. My mom would run a school there, because the Germans wanted everybody to feel like everything was normal. But then every Tuesday, a train came that would be stuffed with people and would leave for a destination. Nobody knew exactly where, but they knew it wasn't good.
Hmm.
And that later on turned out to be another death camp.
Did they have a real sense of what exactly was at the other end of that train stop?
No, they were not. But at some point, there was some information trickling in to Dutch resistance workers who would infiltrate the camp and who would tell people, try to get out of here, try not to get into the train on Tuesday because it brings you to a death.
Mm.
But they were stuck there, and then they were deported in 1944 to Bergen-Belsen, and that was a much worse camp even than Westerbork. There was no food, there was no hygiene, everybody had typhus or tuberculosis, there was incredible hunger, there was no fresh water, there were no sanitary facility. It was horrible and very cold in the winter. So they were there my mother, her parents, her brother, her sister. And then in April 1945, they were very ill, but still alive. And the Germans were getting nervous about the Allied forces coming closer, and they wanted to destroy all living evidence of their concentration camps. So they shipped 2,500 people, among them my mother and her family. They shipped them further eastwards in April 1945 to be gassed at Theresienstadt. Theresienstadt by that time had gas chambers, so that would be a quick death, and where their existence would have been erased. On their way to that death camp, to the gas chambers, the 9th American Army stopped the train and liberated it. And that was on April 13, 1945. My mother would every year celebrate with us on April 13 and give thanks to the Americans, because thanks to what the Americans did on that day, our family exists. So that's also what you will see in the film. The film team found a veteran of 97 years old who had personally opened the doors of that train and liberated the people in there, among them my family. And the film team had me fly out to meet this veteran, which was one of the most moving moments in my life.
Oh, I bet.
To be able to say thank you to him in person.
Oh. And he was pretty bright and alert for a guy in his 90s. He was, you could just tell, and that had really impacted him. You could just tell that affected him for the rest of his life, to be able to save those people like that. I just can't imagine that. Going back to something that you had said earlier, because some of the darker moments of the war, I think, were this notion of collaborators. And among them were some Jewish people that were collaborators. Some of them were kind of incidental collaborators. There was, I think it was called the Jewish Council, or set up in 1941, if I remember right, there in the Netherlands. It was ostensibly, they thought anyway, they were helping Jews, but they were apparently just identifying and helping the Nazis, you know, find where all the Jews were. But then you've got other collaborators. There's one, Anna von Dietsch, I think her name is. She was a Jewish woman, turned over her own brother to the Jews. And, of course, she's doing it out of preservation. I mean, wartime's a horrible thing that people would be doing these kinds of things. And then you've got other people like George Soros, who was apparently himself a collaborator, at least according to his own interviews. But regardless, nowadays he clearly hates Israel. What do you, as a Jew, think of people like George Soros or some of those other collaborators that were helping target the Jews back then?
I have to rely on my mother's observations there, because she lived and through it. I did not. I was born after World War II. But what she taught me, and I had similar questions to her, like you ask me now. What she always answered to me was that these circumstances of the Holocaust, the persecution, were so different from normal, such a crisis situation, that she has seen people behave in very unexpected ways. She said, and even she herself behaved in a way that you wouldn't expect from her. She said, I have seen the most noble, educated, people, leaders, rabbis, who turned under those horrific circumstances in people who would steal the bread of their own child in the camps. And she says, I have seen the biggest criminals, crooks, uneducated people, you name it, old, young, who turned from being, how do you say, you wouldn't expected of them. They I've seen those people, or some of those people, turn into the biggest heroes, into, you know, the biggest people who would suffer themselves to make it better for others.
Wow.
Altruistic people. So she said you wouldn't expect that in many cases, but or people without a lot of education who did the smartest things to save themselves and others.
Wow. Unfortunately, we're up against the clock here. Let's have you continue that thought right after this. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Dr. Evelyn Marcus. And welcome back. This is the I Spy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and the filmmaker behind Never Again Is Now. Absolutely terrific film about the rise of anti-Semitism that's going on right now. Relates the experiences of her parents growing up in World War II and some of the similarities to then as to what's going on now. Dr. Marcus, unfortunately, I had to interrupt you there in that last segment about some of the incredible both acts of heroism and also cowardice by people that are caught up in this. It's certainly about self-preservation. Can you continue your thoughts there?
Yes. So, for instance, my mother herself wasn't a very heroic person as how I knew her. After the Holocaust, she was a bit of a person who got scared easily. But during the Holocaust at the concentration camp Bergen-Belsen, she set up a whole hospital with nothing but to give people some care who were severely ill, while she was severely ill herself. But just to, you know, give people the illusion they were taken care of while they were so ill. And she arranged for all that with the Nazis, with the guards. So that was pretty heroic, I think, and she managed to succeed. She succeeded in setting that up. Not that they could give any real medical care there, but it was just at least care. So something I wouldn't have expected her to do, but she did. So under these circumstances, people do different things you wouldn't expect. Now, after World War II, and it's my generation that was born then, I have seen, especially in Europe, several reactions to this history of our parents. There were people who became really Zionists and, you know, wanted to help build and defend the new Jewish safe space, Israel. And there were others who would try to make themselves as invisible as possible. This is more in Europe than in America. Would make themselves as invisible as possible as Jews, to, you know, out of fear that something similar might happen, that if you were recognizable as a Jew, you would be persecuted and killed. So I've also seen some people, it's a small minority, but there are some people, some Jews, who turned against everything Jewish, like, and emotionally turned against it and said it was bad. Judaism is bad, that Israel is bad, that everything Jewish or Israeli is bad. I've seen that, let's say, psychological reaction as well. With a small minority of Jews, but I've seen it. Whether that explains the point of view of Mr. Soros, I cannot answer. I don't know him personally. I cannot answer. I cannot look into his head. But he's not the only one who he would not be the only one who would be against Zionism in Israel because of emotional inheritance from the Holocaust.
Well, it definitely shows you that you just can't judge people because you're just not inside their heads. and you don't know what they're going through, for sure. So after the war, though, in terms of healing and bringing the communities back together in terms of healing families, did things get talked about much? I know that kind of the perception is back in the day that, you know, our grandparents and parents didn't necessarily do a lot of talking. But, I mean, how did they begin to heal? I mean, did the Jewish community itself talk a lot about the Holocaust? Or did they just want to put the past behind them?
So my family was a big, big exception to the rest of the Jews in Holland. Because my mother survived, barely, but she survived together with her whole direct family, her parents, her brother, her sister. Again, barely, but they survived. So she didn't lose anybody from her direct family during the Holocaust. Also, she found her fiancé back. And he also came back with his direct family, his two brothers and his two parents. This is unique. Look at my partner, Rosa. She grew up being the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, her mother, who had lost all the family. So Rosa doesn't have grandparents from her mother's side. Her father was not Jewish. Her mother came back as the only member of the family. Standard. That is standard. Jews of my generation usually didn't know any grandparents, didn't know any aunts, or didn't have any aunts or uncles. What was the question?
Oh, I was just talking about how they managed to heal after all of that.
Right. So in my family, because my parents always, you know, I knew them as people who would celebrate life. My mother would keep her fears about political developments, about the rise of tyranny, for instance, in the Soviet Union, and whether that could come our way in Western Europe or not. But they would keep their vigilance, but they were happy because they had everybody around them still intact. Mm. But that was not standard. Rosa's family is much more an example of how it was for most European Jews of my age. Her mother did great after the Holocaust, but she struggled emotionally immensely every day of her life. She was pretty depressed. And also, it was difficult to grow up with parents like that.
Sure.
They would typically have the attitude of nothing can make up for my loss, and everything you as a child think is a problem is not really a problem because we had bigger problems.
Sure.
So,
I just find it so fascinating that here we are just a couple of generations later. You've got all of those personal stories, and yet we've circled back around to anti-Semitism. I want to talk to you about that in the next break. Everyone stay with us. And welcome back. This has been a fascinating discussion with Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and activist on anti-Semitism. Her family came through the Holocaust. Her mom and dad managed to survive with both their families intact, a true anomaly. Her film is Never Again is Now. It's available on Amazon Prime. If you remember on that, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. And, you know, as I mentioned there, you guys were really a statistical anomaly. And what is, it's kind of hard to understand, really, is you've got all of these families out there in Europe with their own direct experiences who can all share their own stories of personally suffering losses and be able to say, wait a minute, my family went through this kind of anti-Semitism. This is the kinds of things that happen. You'd think with all of that level of personal connections, it would be a very powerful testimony against anti-Semitism. So why is anti-Semitism on the rise again in Europe when so many people have those personal experiences?
It works in a couple of ways. This knowledge about what happened during the Holocaust. First of all, it was for the guilt about Nazism and the Holocaust was the main reason for Germany, for Angela Merkel's government, to say, let as many refugees in as we can. Or as she said in German, wir schaffen es, we can do it, we can do it, we can have more refugees. So they let in more than 1 million refugees in 2015 alone. What they didn't realize was that these refugees were coming from countries, from Muslim-majority countries, where anti-Semitism is sky high. It's about four times as high as anywhere else in the world. So they brought their anti-Semitism with them to Germany, and the same thing happened in other Western European countries. And now these people are hunting Jews. So we see Jews in Berlin, Jews in Munich, Jews in Amsterdam, Jews in Paris, Jews in Antwerp being stabbed, being beaten up, being scolded, being killed even by people who Western Europe was trying to save from from war. So that's a very unfortunate situation.
Well, but you would think, though, that Germany, which, of course, was the epicenter for so much anti-Semitism, once they started letting all of these immigrants in, whether it's guilt or not, you would think that they'd be able to look around and say, here we are again. So why didn't they shut the door? In fact, if anything, they're working to keep it open.
They're willing to keep it open, and they're suppressing the statistics, and they're advising the Jews to stay invisible as Jews, don't wear any Jewish symbols in the street. So it got out of their control. That's they mean as a political party, as politicians, they don't want to admit their mistake and just pretend that if there's not a problem.
Well,
although they acknowledge that there is a rise of anti-Semitism, but they try to suppress the information where it's coming from.
Well, what I found to be hugely surprising when you confronted with it in your film the way that you are, is that you've got these mass protests going on where people are shouting Hamas, Hamas, Jews to the gas. But among those, you have these far left politicians also calling for violence against Israel and against Jews. That's where you think, why haven't the German people learned their lesson?
Okay, that's I think, a great question. Because you're right. We see anti-Semitism in Europe coming mainly from the Muslim immigrant population, but also coming for as big a part from the left, or and certainly the hard left, in the political spectrum, albeit not that those incidents are not so violent. But there is also a solidarity between the left political spectrum and the Muslim immigrant population. So they have each other's backs in this. So we see what we have seen already starting before Muslim immigrants arrived in big numbers in Europe, was that the hard left, especially at universities, and that's what we see now in the United States exactly in the same way, academia flipped from being pro-Israel to being anti-Israel, and in a very enthusiastic way. So it became hatred of Israel, and it spilled over into hatred of the occupying, privileged, white, privileged Jew.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is coming from all the feelings that have always been there in Europe, and also a lot of it was fed by the Soviet Union in the 60s and the 70s during the Cold War. The Soviet Union flipped from being pro-Israel to being anti-Israel and pumped a lot of anti-Semitic propaganda into the left.
Well, I just think that somebody like yourself, whose parents could tell you what it was like going through that. I mean, this sort of rise of anti-Semitism that you're seeing both in Europe and now here in the U.S. to a large part, that's just got to be really terrifying. We will take a break here. Coming back, we'll wrap things up with Dr. Evelyn Marcus. And welcome back. We're wrapping this up with Dr. Evelyn Marcus. She's an author, speaker, and filmmaker. She's the filmmaker behind Never Again Is Now, an absolutely terrific film about the rise of anti-Semitism. And you can get that on Amazon Prime. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just look for that on the links on today's show page. So in the time that we have left with you, first of all, I'd like to read this statement because I think this is just so telling in terms of what you guys are up against. This is from a Dutch counterterrorism official, Yasmina Heifey. She says, ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. It's part of a plan by Zionists who are deliberately trying to blacken Islam's name. So she says ISIS is a Zionist conspiracy to defame Islam. I mean, this is somebody who has described herself as an activist for the Dutch Labor Party. I mean, how do you fight back against that sort of disinformation?
Well, first of all, by giving publicity to it, which has happened in Holland when she tweeted this. It was in all the news media. And a thing that is pretty much omitted is looking into how a person like that could land on a position at a national security position.
Yes.
For Dutch government. How did that happen? How did she get there? How did she get through the screening? So that has not been looked into for as far as I know. So that I think is underestimated. There have always been forces that want to infiltrate governments anywhere in the world. There have always been enemies who want to infiltrate. But it seems like there is not enough awareness of hardcore Islamists, the hardcore defenders of Islamism in their heart, who try to infiltrate government.
Hmm. And we have certainly seen that. We have had a former jihadist on our show a number of times, Kamal Saleem. And he talks about that, about the infiltration within our society. He was personally commissioned to come here back in the 80s to infiltrate America. He knows that there are other jihadists that have managed to work their way into the U.S. government. I mean, it's really terrifying in many ways. I mean, to somebody whose parents went through the Holocaust and World War II, it almost has to feel to you like the war never ended. It's just sort of a lull.
Yes, it's... When we saw anti-Semitism, when my partner Rose and I saw anti-Semitism rising out of hand in Europe after 2000, and we got the opportunity in 2006 to move to the United States, we thought, let's take the signs, the early signs, serious and move out of here. And so we did. Mm. And the big... worry is that we see those signs start here as well. It's not as far here as it is in Europe. In Europe, half of the Jews consider to leave or have already left, like we did. Assuming that in Europe it's too late for the Jewish population right now, again, even though it's not as lethal or not as lethal yet as it was in World War II, Europe is not a good and safe place anymore for Jews.
No.
But let's hope that America is not going in the same direction.
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, that probably surprised you in this last election. I mean, here you leave Europe where you're experiencing this anti-Semitism, and you come to America where this sort of thing shouldn't be happening. And yet in the last election, you had two very anti-Israel representatives get elected, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. I mean, that had to be very discouraging to see that sort of thing happening right here in the land that's supposed to be the home of the brave and land of the free.
Yeah, well, in America, in the past few years, I've seen anti-Semitism rise and coming from three sides. One side is white supremacists. We've seen two deadly attacks on synagogues in the past year in America, Pittsburgh and near San Diego. Then we see American campuses have 200 branches of Students for Justice in Palestine who deny the right of existence. They don't want Israel to exist. And so we have 200 branches on our campuses. And we also have seen more than 10 imams were spotted. These were spotted, so we don't know how many we didn't spot. But more than 10 imams were spotted in prayer services in America, in mosques, calling for the annihilation of the Jews.
Wow, wow. That is absolutely horrific. Unfortunately, we are up against the clock here, but I would definitely love to have you back on to talk some more about this. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Mark, for your interview and for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
One of the more moving lines in the film was that everyone's family has an uncle so-and-so who had a visa for a free country in his pocket but didn't go because, oh, it won't get that bad. Like Dr. Marcus said, we have to take a stand early on when you first start seeing the rise of hate, that you fight it every time and don't let it get a foothold. Sounds a lot like Trump, doesn't it? I do hope you watch that film. Never Again is now. Links to it are on our show page, iSpyRadio.com. Watch it, take it to heart, share it, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.